First Reforms. Chapter 10. Opposition. While the grammarian Melanchthon was contributing by these gentle strains a powerful support to Luther, men of authority, enemies to the reformer, were turning violently against him. He had escaped from the Wartburg and reappeared on the stage of the world, and at this news the rage of his former enemies was revived. Luther had been 3 months and a half at Wittenberg when a rumor, increased by the thousand tongues of fame, brought intelligence that one of the greatest kings of Christendom had risen against him. Henry VIII, head of the House of Tudor, a prince descended from the families of York and Lancaster, and in whose person, after so much bloodshed, the red and white roses were at length united, the mighty king of England, who claimed to re-establish on the continent, and especially in France, the former influence of his crown, had just written a book against the poor monk of Wittenberg. "There is much boasting about a little book by the King of England," wrote Luther to Lang on the 26th of June, 1522. Henry was then 31 years old. He was tall, strong-built and proportioned, and had an air of authority and empire. His countenance expressed the vivacity of his mind, vehement, presuming to make everything give way to the violence of his passions, and thirsting for glory, he at first concealed his faults under a certain impetuosity that is peculiar to youth, and flatterers were not wanting to encourage them. He would often visit, in company with his courtiers, the house of his chaplain, Thomas Wolsey, the son of an Ipswich butcher. Endowed with great skill, of overweening ambition, and of unbounded audacity, this man, protected by the Bishop of Winchester, Chancellor of the Kingdom, had rapidly advanced in his master's favor, and allured him to his residence by the attractions of pleasures and disorders, in which the young prince would not have ventured to indulge in his own palace. This is recorded by Polydore Virgil, at that time papal subcollector in England. In these dissolute meetings, the chaplain surpassed the licentiousness of the young courtiers who attended Henry VIII. Forgetful of the decorum befitting a minister of the church, he would sing, dance, laugh, play the fool, fence, and indulge in obscene conversation. By these means he succeeded in obtaining the first place in the king's councils, and, as sole minister, all the princes of Christendom were forced to purchase his favor. Henry lived in the midst of balls, banquets, and jousting, and madly squandered the treasures his father had slowly accumulated. Magnificent tournaments succeeded each other without interval. In these sports the king, who was distinguished above all the combatants by his manly beauty, played the chief part. If the contest appeared for a moment doubtful, the strength and address of the young monarch, or the artful policy of his opponents, gave him the victory, and the list resounded with shouts and applause in his honor. The vanity of the youthful prince was inflated by these easy triumphs, and there was no success in the world to which he thought he might not aspire. The queen was often seen among the spectators. Her serious features and sad look, her absent and dejected air, contrasted strongly with the noise and glitter of these festivities. Shortly after his accession to the throne, Henry VIII had espoused for reasons of state Catherine of Aragon, his senior by 8 years. She was his brother Arthur's widow, and aunt to Charles V. While her husband followed his pleasures, the virtuous Catherine, whose piety was truly Spanish, would leave her bed in the middle of the night to take a silent part in the prayers of the monks. She would kneel down without cushion or carpet. At 5 in the morning, after taking a little rest, she would again rise, and putting on the Franciscan dress, for she had been admitted into the tertiary order of St. Francis, and hastily throwing the royal garments around her, would repair to church at 6 o'clock to join in the service. Two beings, living in such different spheres, could not long continue together. Romish piety had other representatives besides Catherine in the court of Henry VIII. John Fisher, Bishop of Rochester, then nearly 70 years of age, as distinguished for learning as for the austerity of his manners, was the object of universal veneration. He had been the oldest counselor of Henry VII, and the Duchess of Richmond, grandmother to Henry VIII, calling him to her bedside, had commended to his care the youth and inexperience of her grandson. The king, in the midst of his irregularities, long continued to revere the aged bishop as a father. A man much younger than Fisher, a layman and lawyer, had before this attracted general attention by his genius and noble character. His name was Thomas More, son of one of the judges of the King's Bench. He was poor, austere, and diligent. At the age of 20 he had endeavored to quench the passions of youth by wearing a shirt of haircloth, and by self-scourging. On one occasion, being summoned by Henry VIII while he was attending Mass, he replied that God's service was before the king's. Wolsey introduced him to Henry, who employed him on various embassies, and showed him much kindness. He would often send for him, and converse with him on astronomy, on Wolsey, and on divinity. In truth, the king himself was not acquainted with the Romish doctrines. It would appear that if Arthur had lived, Henry was destined for the archiepiscopal see of Canterbury. Thomas Aquinas, St. Bonaventure, tournaments, banquets, Elizabeth Blunt, and others of his mistresses all were mixed up in the mind and life of this prince, who had masses of his own composition sung in his chapel. As soon as Henry had heard talk of Luther, he became indignant against him, and hardly was the decree of the Diet of Worms known in England, before he ordered the pontiff's bull against the reformer's works to be put in execution. On the 12th of May 1521, Thomas Wolsey, who, together with the office of Chancellor of England, combined those of Cardinal and Legate of Rome, went in solemn procession to St. Paul's. This man, whose pride had attained the highest pitch, thought himself the equal of kings. He used to sit in a chair of gold, sleep in a golden bed, and a cover of cloth of gold was spread on the table at his meals. On this occasion he displayed great magnificence. His household, consisting of 800 persons, among whom were barons, knights, and sons of the most distinguished families, who hoped by serving him to obtain public office, surrounded this haughty prelate. Silk and gold glittered not only on his garments, he was the first ecclesiastic who ventured to dress so sumptuously, but even on the housings and harness of the horses. Before walked a tall priest bearing a silver column terminated by a cross. Behind him, another ecclesiastic of similar height carried the archiepiscopal crozier of York. A nobleman at his side held the cardinal's hat. Lords, prelates, ambassadors from the Pope and Emperor accompanied him, followed by a long line of mules bearing chests covered with the richest and most brilliant hangings. It was this magnificent procession that was carrying to the burning pile the writings of the poor monk of Wittenberg. When they reached the cathedral, the insolent priest placed his cardinal's hat on the altar. The virtuous Bishop of Rochester stationed himself at the foot of the cross, and with agitated voice preached earnestly against the heresy. After this, the impious books of the heresiarch were brought together and devoutly burned in the presence of an immense crowd. Such was the first intelligence that England received of the Reformation. Henry would not stop here. This prince, whose hand was ever upraised against his adversaries, his wives, or his favorites, wrote to the Elector Palatine, "It is the devil who, by Luther's means, has kindled this immense conflagration. If Luther will not be converted, let him and his writings be burned together." This was not enough. Having been convinced that the progress of heresy was owing to the extreme ignorance of the German princes, Henry thought the moment had arrived for showing his learning. The victories of his battle axe did not permit him to doubt of those that were reserved for his pen. But another passion, vanity, ever greatest in the smallest minds, spurred the king onward. He was humiliated at having no title to oppose to that of Catholic and Most Christian, borne by the kings of Spain and France, and he had long been begging a similar distinction from the court of Rome. What would be more likely to procure it than to attack upon heresy? Henry therefore threw aside the kingly purple and descended from his throne into the arena of theological discussion. He enlisted Thomas Aquinas, Peter Lombard, Alexander Hales, and Bonaventure into his service, and the world beheld the publication of the Defense of the Seven Sacraments against Martin Luther by the most invincible king of England and France, Lord of Ireland, Henry VIII of that name. "I will rush in front of the church to save her," said the King of England in this treatise. "I will receive in my bosom the poisoned arrows of her assailants. The present state of things calls me to do so. Every servant of Christ, whatever be his age, sex, or rank, should rise up against the common enemy of Christendom. Let us put on a twofold breastplate, the heavenly breastplate, to conquer by the weapons of truth him who combats with those of error, but also an earthly breastplate, that if he shows himself obstinate in his malice, the hand of the executioner may constrain him to be silent, and that once at least he may be useful to the world by the terrible example of his death." Henry VIII was unable to hide the contempt he felt towards his feeble adversary. "This man," said the crown theologian, "seems to be in the pangs of childbirth. After a travail without precedent, he produces nothing but wind. Remove the daring envelope of the insolent verbiage with which he clothes his absurdities, as an ape is clothed in purple, and what remains? A wretched and empty sophism. The king defends successively the mass, penance, confirmation, marriage, orders, and extreme unction. He is not sparing of abusive language towards his opponent. He calls him by turns a wolf of hell, a poisonous viper, a limb of the devil. Even Luther's sincerity is attacked. Henry VIII crushes the mendicant monk with his royal anger, and writes his tour with his scepter, says an historian. And yet it must be confessed that his work was not bad, considering the author and his age. The style is not altogether without force, but the public of the day did not confine themselves to paying it due justice. The theological treatise of the powerful King of England was received with a torrent of adulation. The most learned work the sun ever saw, cried some. We can only compare it, re-echoed others, to the works of Augustine. He is a Constantine, a Charlemagne. He is more, said others. He is a second Solomon. These flatteries soon extended beyond the limits of England. Henry desired John Clark, Dean of Windsor, his ambassador at Rome, to present his book to the sovereign pontiff. Leo X received the honor in full consistory. Clark laid the royal work before him, saying, The king, my master, assures you that, having now refuted Luther's errors with the pen, he is ready to combat his adherents with the sword. Leo, touched with this promise, replied, that the king's book could not have been written without the aid of the Holy Ghost, and conferred upon Henry the title of Defender of the Faith, which is still borne by the sovereigns of England. The reception which this volume met with at Rome contributed greatly to increase the number of its readers. In a few months many thousand copies issued from different presses. The whole Christian world, says Cocleus, was filled with admiration and joy. Such extravagant panegyrics augmented the insufferable vanity of this chief of the Tudors. He himself seemed to have no doubt that he was inspired by the Holy Ghost. From that time he would suffer no contradiction. His papacy was no longer at Rome, but at Greenwich. Infallibility reposed on his shoulders. At a subsequent period this contributed greatly to the Reformation of England. Luther read Henry's book with a smile mingled with disdain, impatience, and indignation. The falsehood and the abuse it contained, but especially the air of contempt and compassion which the king assumed, irritated the Wittenberg doctor to the highest degree. The thought that the Pope had crowned this work, and that on all sides the enemies of the gospel were triumphing over the Reformation and the Reformer, as already overthrown and vanquished, increased his indignation. Besides, what reason had he to temporize? Was he not fighting in the cause of a king greater than all the kings of the earth? The meekness of the gospel appeared to him unseasonable. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. He went beyond all bounds. Persecuted, insulted, hunted down, wounded, the furious lion turned round, and proudly roused himself to crush his enemy. The elector, Spalatin, Melanchthon, and Bugenhagen, strove in vain to pacify him. They would have prevented his replying, but nothing could stop him. I will not be gentle towards the King of England, said he. I know that it is vain for me to humble myself, to give way, to entreat, to try peaceful methods. At length I will show myself more terrible towards these furious beasts, who goad me every day with their horns. I will turn mine upon them. I will provoke Satan until he falls down lifeless and exhausted. If this heretic does not recant, says Henry VIII, the new Thomas, he must be burned alive. Such are the weapons they are not employing against me. The fury of stupid asses and swine of the brood of Thomas Aquinas, and then the stake. Well then, be it so. Let these hogs advance if they dare, and let them burn me. Here I am waiting for them. After my death, though my ashes should be thrown into a thousand seas, they will rise, pursue, and swallow up this abominable herd. Living, I shall be the enemy of the papacy. Burnt, I shall be its destruction. Go then, swine of St. Thomas, do what seemeth good to you. You will ever find Luther like a bear upon your way, and as a lion in your path. He will spring upon you whithersoever you go, and will never leave you at peace, until he has broken your iron heads, and ground your brazen foreheads into dust. Luther first reproaches Henry VIII with having supported his doctrine solely by the decrees and opinions of men. As for me, says he, I never cease crying the gospel, Christ, Christ. And my adversaries continue to reply, Custom, custom. Ordinances, ordinances. Fathers, fathers, St. Paul says, let not your faith stand in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God, 1 Corinthians 2 verse 5. And the apostle by this thunderclap from heaven overthrows and disperses, as the wind scatters the dust, all the hobgoblins of this Henry. Frightened and confounded, these Thomists, Papists, and Henrys fall prostrate before the thunder of these words. He then refutes the king's book in detail, and overturns his arguments one after the other, with the perspicuity, spirit, and knowledge of the holy scriptures and history of the church, but also with an assurance, disdain, and sometimes violence, that ought not to surprise us. Having reached the end of his confutation, Luther again becomes indignant that his opponent should derive his arguments from the fathers only. This was the basis of the whole controversy. To all the world of the Father and of men, of angels and of devils, said he, I oppose not old customs, not the multitude of men, but the word of eternal majesty, the gospel, which even my adversaries are obliged to recognize. To this I hold fast, on this I repose, in this I boast, in this I exult and triumph over the Papists, the Thomists, the Henrys, the Sophists, and all the swine of hell. The King of Heaven is with me. For this reason I fear nothing, although 1,000 Augustines, 1,000 Cyprians, and 1,000 of these churches which Henry defends should rise up against me. It is a small matter that I should despise and revile a king of the earth, since he himself does not fear in his writings to blaspheme the King of Heaven, and to profane his holy name by the most impudent falsehoods. Papists, exclaimed he in conclusion, will ye never cease from your idle attacks? Do what you please. Nevertheless, before that gospel which I preach down must come popes, bishops, priests, monks, princes, devils, death, sin, and all that is not Christ or in Christ. Thus spoke the poor monk. His violence certainly cannot be excused, if we judge it by the rule to which he himself appealed, by the word of God. It cannot even be justified by alleging either the grossness of the age, for Melanchthon knew how to observe decorum in his writings, or the energy of his character. For if this energy had any influence over his language, passion also exerted more. It is better, then, that we should condemn it. And yet, that we may be just, we should observe decorum in his writings, or the energy of his character. For if this energy had any influence over his language, passion also exerted more. It is better, then, that we should condemn it. And yet, that we may be just, we should observe that in the 16th century this violence did not appear so strange as it would nowadays. The learned were then in a state, as well as the princes. By becoming a writer, Henry had attacked Luther. Luther replied according to the established law in the Republic of Letters, that we must consider the truth of what is said, and not the quality of him that says it. Let us add also, that when the same king turned against the Pope, the abuse which the Romish writers and the Pope himself poured upon him far exceeded all that Luther had ever said. Besides, if Luther called Dr. Eck an ass and Henry VIII a hog, he indignantly rejected the intervention of the secular arm. While Eck was writing a dissertation to prove that heretics ought to be burned, and Henry was erecting scaffolds that he might conform with the precepts of the Chancellor of Ingolstadt. Great was the emotion at the King's Court. Surrey, Wolsey, and the crowd of courtiers put a stop to the festivities and pageantry at Greenwich to vent their indignation in abuse and sarcasm. The venerable Bishop of Rochester, who had been delighted to see the young prince, formerly confided to his care, breaking a lance in defense of the church, was deeply wounded by the attack of the monk. He replied to it immediately. His words distinctly characterized the age and the church. Take us the foxes, the little foxes, that spoil the vines, says Christ in the Psalm of Songs. This teaches us, said Fisher, that we must take the heretics before they grow big. Now Luther is become a big fox, so old, so cunning, and so sly, that he is very difficult to catch. What do I say, a fox? He is a mad dog, a ravening wolf, a cruel bear, or rather all those animals in one, for the monster includes many beasts within him. Thomas More also descended into the arena to contend with the monk of Wittenberg. Although a layman, his zeal against the Reformation amounted to fanaticism, if it did not even urge him to shed blood. When young nobles undertake the defense of the papacy, their violence often exceeds even that of the ecclesiastics. Reverend Brother, Father, Tipler, Luther, renegade of the Order of St. Augustine, misshapen bacchanal of either faculty, unlearned doctor of theology. Such is the language addressed to the reformer by one of the most illustrious men of his age. He then proceeds to explain the manner in which Luther had composed his book against Henry VIII. He called his companions together, and desired them to go each his own way and pick up all sorts of abuse and scurrility. One frequented the public carriages and boats, another the baths and gambling houses, a third the taverns and barber's shops, a fourth the mills and brothels. They noted down in their tablets all the most insolent, filthy, and infamous things they heard, and bringing back all these abominations and impurities, they discharged them into that filthy kennel which is called Luther's mind. If he retracts his falsehoods and calumnies, continues more, if he lays aside his folly and his madness, if he swallows his own filth, he will find one who will seriously discuss with him. But if he proceeds as he has begun, joking, teasing, fooling, calumniating, vomiting sewers and cesspools, let others do what they please. As for me, I should prefer leaving the little friar to his one fury and filth. More would have done better to have restrained his own. Luther never degraded his style to so low a degree. He made no reply. This writing still further increased Henry's attachment to More. He would often visit him in his humble dwelling at Chelsea. After dinner, the king, leaning on his favorite's shoulder, would walk in the garden, while Mistress More and her children, concealed behind a window, could not turn away their astonished eyes. After one of these walks, More, who knew his man well, said to his wife, "If my head could win him a single castle in France, he would not hesitate to cut it off." The king, thus defended by the Bishop of Rochester and by his future chancellor, had no need to resume his pen. Confounded at finding himself treated in the face of Europe as a common writer, Henry VIII abandoned the dangerous position he had taken, and throwing away the pen of the theologian, had recourse to the more effectual means of diplomacy. An ambassador was dispatched from the court of Greenwich with a letter for the Elector and Dukes of Saxony. "Luther, the real serpent fallen from heaven," wrote he, "is pouring out his floods of venom upon the earth. He is stirring up revolts in the Church of Jesus Christ, abolishing laws, insulting the powers that be, inflaming the laity against the priests, and laymen and priests against the Pope, subjects against their sovereigns, and desires nothing better than to see Christians fighting and destroying one another, and the enemies of our faith hailing this scene of carnage with a frightful grin. What is this doctrine which he calls evangelical, if it be not Wycliffe's? Now, most honored uncles, I know what your ancestors have done to destroy it. In Bohemia they hunted it down like a wild beast, and driving it into a pit, they shut it up and kept it fast. You will not allow it to escape through your negligence, lest, creeping into Saxony, and becoming master of the whole of Germany, its smoking nostrils should pour forth the flames of hell, spreading that conflagration far and wide which your nation has so often wished to extinguish in its blood. For this reason, most worthy princes, I feel obliged to exhort you and even to entreat you in the name of all that is most sacred, promptly to extinguish the cursed sect of Luther. Put no one to death, if that can be avoided. But if this heretical obstinacy continues, then shed blood without hesitation, in order that the abominable heresy may disappear from under heaven." The Elector and his brother referred the kings to the approaching council. Thus Henry VIII was far from attaining his end. "So great a name mixed up in the dispute," said Paul Sarpi, "served to render it more curious, and to conciliate general favor towards Luther, as usually happens in combats and tournaments, where the spectators have always a leaning to the weaker party, and take delight in exaggerating the merit of his actions.